Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you all for coming. It's truly a delight to be here in Louisville, Kentucky. And what an honor and privilege to discuss Thomas Merton with you this evening. The title of my talk is Contemplation in Times of Crisis. Thomas Merton, as I'm sure you are all aware, was a great Catholic contemplative of the 20th century. He was both a Trappist monk and a prophetic writer. His works continue to resonate today, over 50 years after his death. In Pope Francis's 2015 address to Congress, he praised Merton, along with Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., and Dorothy Day, as four American witnesses of Christian faith and social action. Merton lived in times of crisis, and I dare say that we do as well. His autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, begins in this way. Quote, on the last day of January 1915, under the sign of the water bearer, in a year of great war, and down in the shadow of some French mountains on the borders of Spain, I came into the world. Free by nature, in the image of God, I was nevertheless the prisoner of my own violence and my own selfishness, in the image of the world into which I was born. That world was the picture of hell, full of men like myself, loving God and yet hating him, born to love him, living instead in fear and hopeless, self-contradictory hungers. End quote. The backdrop to Merton's infancy was the horror of the First World War. Men in trenches being shot and blown to bits, all in the name of some supposed national self-interest. Merton would also live through the Second World War, in which he would lose his younger brother, John Paul, and the first decades of the so-called Cold War, which in fact became extremely hot and deadly in prolonged proxy wars throughout Latin America, Africa, and Asia. He witnessed extraordinary technological achievements that promised progress for society, but also brought the threat of universal destruction, particularly through the proliferation of nuclear arms. In the United States, where he spent much of his adult life, he observed the injustices and cruelties of Jim Crow, including not only segregation, but also lynching, disenfranchisement, and many other kinds of violent treatment in both the South and the North, inflicted on people who were at the time called Negroes. He was inspired by the moral heroism of the civil rights movement and disheartened by the moral failings of many white Christians who refused its calls to conversion and holiness. In addition to deepening his dialogue with East Asian contemplative traditions such as Zen, he spent the last years of his life reflecting on the volatile racial conflicts of the 1960s United States. He wrote about the rise of Black Power movements, which filled him with some ambivalence, and the reactionary responses to these movements by white Christian conservatives and liberals alike, responses which he condemned as both cowardly and unchristian. Merton often used the Greek word kairos, which is prominent in the New Testament, to speak about a time of crisis that calls for a very significant decision. He once asked sharply, quote, can Christians recognize their kairos? End quote. That is, are they capable of making bold and necessary choices to address the violent circumstances of their societies and of their own souls? Merton was not sure that Christians would be up to the task. Indeed, he had severe doubts. Even if they had the right doctrines, he understood that they were, as a group and as individuals, not better than anyone else, just as prone to go through their lives with hardened hearts and depraved indifference to the suffering of others. Merton looked around and saw plainly that the world was a violent place. He believed that this violence started in each and every human being, and that Christians were no exception. He lamented this fact because he thought that Christians ought to know better and to do better. If they were actually living their faith consistently, they would be Christ-like in their actions and would revere the presence of Christ in others. They would recognize everyone immediately as a brother or sister, a fellow child of God, and approach them with a spirit of self-giving love. Instead, Merton saw Christians approaching fellow human beings with fear, hostility, and blatant disregard for their own and for others' humanity. In Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, Merton recounts an incident in which several white Catholics at a parish in New Orleans left the church during the middle of a homily. These regular churchgoers, faithful Catholics all, were outraged by the priest's suggestion that Jesus' command to love your neighbor as yourself disallowed and contradicted their segregationist practices. In Merton's judgment, the lesson to be learned from this story was that, quote, one can think himself a good Catholic and be thought one by his neighbors, and still be, in effect, an apostate from the Christian faith, end quote. According to Merton, anti-black racism is a form of apostasy. It is an abdication of the sort of life that Christ demands that we live. Merton wanted to help his readers see that the time was running out for them to make a real choice for Christ and thus for a new way of living in deep communion and solidarity with one another. But he was not particularly optimistic that they would heed his warning and embrace their Kairos moment. Now, two distinct themes run throughout Merton's works. First, he believes that our social and political crises, such as war, racism, poverty, and all other forms of worldly violence, are deeply rooted in our malformed spiritual lives. He argues that these crises must be addressed at this deeper spiritual level if we are going to make any real headway on them. Thus, he offers contemplation as our only source of hope and true and lasting transformation in the world. But second, he contends that devout religious people, including Christians, and even some contemplatives, can be led astray in many disastrous ways. The practice of contemplation can fail to yield the transformative results that one expects from it, and even render one complicit in violence. Therefore, its false or inauthentic forms must be vigorously resisted. In short, then, although Merton would say that contemplation is crucially important for all human beings, especially in times of crisis, in which we must decisively embrace the better and truer versions of ourselves, he would also say that we have got to get contemplation right, or it may only make matters worse. I agree with both of these points, and I think they can help us navigate the crises that we are facing in our own time. In order to make matters a bit more concrete, we can distinguish between crises that are occurring at personal, national, and global levels. I mentioned at the outset that Merton lost his younger brother, John Paul. I want to say a few more things about his grief for his brother and how it affected his early experience of monastic life. Although this personal suffering is very closely tied to a destructive political situation, John Paul's plane was shot down by the German military during combat in the Second World War. This is still a very personally felt crisis for Merton, and we might relate to it today by thinking about our own very personal experiences of pain, loss, or uncertainty in our families or among our close friends. Merton has insights for us at this personal level. Second, I want to consider more closely what Merton says about racism and social movements for racial justice, and how his thoughts on these subjects relate to our current national discourse about them. In short, while some things have certainly changed, and many things for the better, there are also many disquieting similarities between the United States of the 1960s and the United States of the 2020s, particularly on questions of race. As a white Christian who chose to be in solidarity with his black brothers and sisters, and as a thoughtful commentator on the topic of true Christian identity, Merton still has much to teach us on this score. Finally, Merton was concerned about a crisis of truly global proportions, namely the threat of nuclear annihilation. Although this threat remains a feature of 21st century societies, our own apocalyptic imagination has recently turned toward the increasingly frightening facts of climate change, pollution, and environmental injustice. There is no question that we are doing major, irreversible harm to ecosystems throughout the world, and that the poorest and most racially marginalized human communities will bear the brunt of this damage. If Merton is right, and I think he is, then even a crisis of this global magnitude starts with our interior lives and calls for some sort of contemplative remedy. Before considering more closely how Merton might help us navigate to these various crises, I want to first try to clarify what exactly he means by true contemplation and how he seeks to distinguish it from its dangerous counterfeits. Put briefly, true contemplation is the very life of God in the soul. This divine life tends to maintain and hold several basic tensions between the will and the intellect, solitude and society, history and eternity. Merton teaches that contemplation often goes awry by disregarding the latter term in any one of these pairs, that is, intellect, society, or history, or simply by substituting idolatrous pictures of God for the real thing. The question of whether contemplation has to be Christian in order to be true is complicated for Merton, because even though he firmly believes in the truth of Christianity, he also recognizes that outward Christian trappings are no guarantee of genuineness, and that there is deep contemplative wisdom to be found in non-Christian traditions such as Buddhism, Judaism, and Islam. And what follows, my goal is to unpack all of this a bit more, again, first by analyzing in greater detail how Merton defines true and false contemplation, and then by discussing how his application of these principles to the crises of his own day might help us better respond to the crises of our own time. So first, the meaning and tensions of contemplation. In his famous text called The New Seeds of Contemplation, Merton defines it in general terms as, quote, a vivid realization of the fact that life and being in us proceed from an invisible, transcendent, and infinitely abundant source, end quote. A few pages later, he gives a more specific Christian definition of contemplation, citing St. Paul's letter to the Galatians. He writes, quote, "Contemplation is the awareness and realization, even in some sense experience, of what each Christian obscurely believes. It is now no longer I that live, but Christ who lives in me," end quote. Merton says that in contemplation, we discover our real and true selves, the hidden and mysterious persons in whom we subsist before the eyes of God. He adds that contemplation teaches us to distinguish this true, God-given identity from our superficial or exterior selves, the fragile egos that are the products of our greed, pettiness, or pride. Contemplation, according to Merton, is not primarily an activity that we do. It is not a skill to be acquired or an object to be possessed. It is the very grace of God working within us, opening us to higher forms of consciousness, freedom, and love. Merton dedicated his life to the mystery of contemplation. This dedication is made evident in one way by the fact that he chose to become a Cistercian of the strict observance, that is, a Trappist monk, joining the Abbey of Our Lady of Gethsemani in central Kentucky in 1941. However, his writing about contemplation was not meant only for other monks, nor was his goal merely to attract others to this monastic way of life. He was interested in helping lay persons, whether Christians or not, grow in awareness of the divine presence within them. Merton's belief in this universal, but also very deeply personal and intimate divine presence follows logically from his belief in the Christian doctrine of the Incarnation. He writes, quote, "For in becoming man, God became not only Jesus Christ, but also potentially every man and woman that ever existed. In Christ, God became not only this man, but also in a broader and more mystical sense, yet no less truly, every man, every human being," end quote. Although monks like Merton are empowered to focus on contemplation in a particular way because of their vocations, contemplation is in fact meant for everyone. It is a gift of union between God and the human soul, which is accomplished in Christ Jesus, and which calls to each of us in whatever concrete circumstances we may find ourselves. Although contemplation includes a more vibrant and life-giving awareness of God, it does not turn God into a comprehensible object or render the contemplative somehow omniscient. It is as much an experience of unknowing as it is of knowing, because one's finite intellect simply cannot contain the infinite divine wellspring that overflows within. Nevertheless, Merton proceeds with caution here. He insists that true contemplation is not anti-intellectual. He is worried about the threat of what he calls a false mysticism, perceptible in the frenzied political movements of National Socialism and totalitarian communism, which abandons the intellect in favor of, quote, a blind life force or power, considered sometimes as beyond man, sometimes as within himself, end quote. Following John of the Cross and other mystics of the Dark Night, Merton associates the perfection of contemplation with a state of pure love that greatly surpasses what any earthly reason can understand. At the same time, as a very careful student of Thomas Aquinas, Merton also stresses that this is a state of love, not mere blind will, and that such love is inseparable from a gift of divine wisdom and a life of well-ordered, habitual holiness. Merton is highly critical of any religious, political, or erotic enthusiasm that would prize ecstatic experience for its own sake and untether it from the concrete ways of life that Christ teaches us to follow. In addition to holding the tensions between intellect and will and love, Merton also argues that true contemplation must maintain a close bond between solitude and society. He says, quote, physical solitude, exterior silence, and real recollection are all morally necessary for anyone who wants to lead a contemplative life. But he adds, quote, we do not go into the desert to escape people, but to learn how to find them, end quote. By filling us with divine love, contemplation frees us to share this love with others and to find this love already radiant in them. Excuse me if I keep quoting Merton at length, but he has such a way with words, especially on this topic. So bear with me here. He writes, quote, the more we are alone, the more we are together. And the more we are in society, the true society of charity, not of cities and crowds, the more we are alone with Christ. For in my soul and in your soul, I find the same Christ who is our life, and he finds himself in our love, and together we all find paradise, which is the sharing of his love for his Father in the person of their Spirit, end quote. The other passage I want to reproduce in this context is a famous one describing an experience Merton had on the corner of 4th and Walnut. After his most memorable line, quote, there is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. He adds, quote, this changes nothing in the sense and value of my solitude. For it is in fact a function of solitude to make one realize such things with a clarity that would be impossible to anyone completely immersed in other cares, the other illusions, and all the automatisms of a tightly collective existence. My solitude, however, is not my own, for I see now how much it belongs to them, and that I have a responsibility for it in their regard, not just in my own. It is because I am one with them that I owe it to them to be alone. And when I am alone, they are not they, but my own self. There are no strangers. End quote. Therefore, it is quite clear that any pursuit of contemplation, which amounted to a mere practice of navel gazing or self-absorption, would be counted a failure on Merton's grounds. To find God within is to find the truer version of ourselves that does not relate to others with self-interested motives, but rather with deep warmth and understanding and Christ-like commitment. Finally, true contemplation is distinguished from its false counterfeits by its concrete grappling with history. Although Merton acknowledges the eternity of God, he also emphasizes that Christianity is, quote, the salvation of man in and through history, through temporal decisions made for Christ, the Redeemer and Lord of history, end quote. Merton argues that there are kairos moments which test and reveal the extent to which one has let the love of God reinvigorate one's interior life and transform it from a hardened condition of sin into a liberated condition of grace. The seeds of contemplation are planted by every historical experience one undergoes, and the question is only whether one will let them grow and bear fruit. That is, when the time of decision comes, when one has to take a stand against violence and injustice, and perhaps even risk one's life struggling for a more peaceful society, will one make the right choice? Will one's soul have become so verdant and fresh, so alive with divine compassion, that it will freely respond in the just and courageous ways that it must? Or will it shrivel and cower and become lifeless? As long as we exist in this world, Contemplation does not relieve us of the burden of wrestling with historical crises. On the contrary, it compels us to face them head on. So turning now to my second major section, times of crisis, Merton's and our own. Memories of his brother John Paul are scattered throughout Merton's autobiography. He talks about summers on Long Island in the mid-1930s, when John Paul was home from school and they had, quote, nothing to do but go swimming and hang around the house playing hot records, end quote. They would walk to the movies and see whatever was showing, however dismal in quality. They didn't care. He talks about visiting John Paul at college several years later. His brother was a student at Cornell in Ithaca, New York. At this point, Merton had already developed a deep Catholic faith and was planning to join the Franciscan order, though this plan would ultimately come to naught. In any case, he recalls that on this trip, his brother, who is not yet a believer, but a somewhat restless and spiritually curious young man, accompanied him to daily mass. He talks about how his brother drove around in an old dusty Buick, how he decided to take a spontaneous road trip to Mexico in order to photograph Mayan ruins, and ended up investing in a cattle ranch. Both brothers were trying to find themselves. As fighting in the Second World War intensified, Merton received a medical deferral from the local draft board and finally resolved to become a monk at Gethsemane. His brother had already joined the Royal Canadian Air Force and was preparing to go to war. Before John Paul shipped out, he visited Merton at the Abbey and expressed a desire to be baptized. Merton gave him a very quick catechesis, and he was received into the church. The next day he departed, and they would never see each other again. John Paul was killed in action. Merton commemorated his brother with what is perhaps his finest and most personal poem, which I will read to you now. Sweet brother, if I do not sleep, my eyes are flowers for your tomb. And if I cannot eat my bread, my fast shall live like willows where you died. If in the heat I find no water for my thirst shall turn to springs for you, poor traveler. Where, in what desolate and smoky country, lies your poor body, torn and dead? And in what landscape of disaster has your unhappy spirit lost its road? Come, in my labor find a resting place, and in my sorrows lay your head. Or rather, take my life and blood and buy yourself a better bed. Or take my breath and take my death and buy yourself a better rest. When all the men of war are shot and flags have fallen into dust, your cross and mine shall tell men still, Christ died on each for both of us. For in the wreckage of your April, Christ lies slain, and Christ weeps in the ruins of my spring. The money of whose tears shall fall into your weak and friendless hand and buy you back to your own land. The silence of whose tears shall fall like bells upon your alien tomb. Hear them and come, they call you home. Merton's choice to become a monk may have partly indicated a desire to flee the violence of the world. But his brother's death proved that Merton could not escape the pain and chaos all around him, even in the apparent safety of his monastic cell. This violence touched him deeply because he and his brother were one. Merton's insomnia, his hunger, his thirst, his labors, his sorrows, his blood, breath, life, and death all belonged to John Paul. Merton believed that he and his brother, even in their suffering, were intimately united in Christ crucified. Merton's contemplation teaches him that the intensity of this fraternal bond is something that he can and must share with all of God's children all over the world, in whatever walk of life they may be, no matter their race, religion, or nationality. His love for his fallen brother is a paradigm for love as such. His young adult anxiety about what to do with his life was a crisis that only resolved when he found the peace that came from accepting his monastic vocation. But after he embraced this calling, the death of his brother and his own survival became another crisis for him, another time of decision that would require him to respond. His question now was how to awaken the divine love that was already buried like a seed in the hearts of each of us. How to let this love grow so strong and unshakable that the brother-killing violence of this world would finally cease. In Merton's writings on racism, he quotes a line from the first letter of John, quote, "But whoever possesses this world's goods and notices his brother in need and shuts his heart against him, how can the love of God remain in him?" This is 1 John 3:17. The fact that Merton uses this biblical line to characterize black people as his own brothers seems significant to me given everything that he has written about his love for his own biological brother. Merton is arguing that white Christians, in order to be truly Christian, must love black people as intensely as they would love a beloved sibling in need. He contends that, therefore, quote, "the white Christian cannot, in such a situation of racial unrest, be content merely to march with his black brother at the risk of getting his head broken or of being shot," end quote. Even the seemingly heroic self-sacrificial act is just a start, according to Merton, because, quote, "the problem is to eradicate this basic violence and injustice from white society altogether." End quote. That is, if one's own beloved brother were being abused and mistreated, one would not stop with mere symbolic acts of protest, however risky they might be. One would struggle tirelessly until the deepest causes of the abuse and mistreatment were finally addressed, and it finally stopped. One's level of personal commitment would be enduring and unrelenting and unquestionable. Merton's consciousness about problems of racial injustice was raised before he became a monk. While he was teaching English at St. Bonaventure College in upstate New York, he attended a lecture by the Baroness Catherine de Hook Doherty, a Catholic laywoman who operated a friendship house in Harlem to serve the needs of the predominantly black population. The Baroness argued in this lecture that communists were making inroads into the black community in Harlem because they were actually doing the works of mercy that Catholics and other Christians should have been doing. The communists were treating black people like true brothers and sisters, making sure they had food, shelter, health care, education, and fighting for their civil rights. Catholics, by and large, were not doing any of these things. Merton was morally convicted by this lecture, and he decided to spend several weeks working with the Baroness in Harlem. His account of what he experienced is, on the one hand, full of compassion and righteous anger, and, on the other hand, somewhat condescending and stigmatizing. He writes, quote, "Here in this huge, dark, steaming slum, hundreds of thousands of Negroes are herded together like cattle, most of them with nothing to eat and nothing to do. In this huge cauldron, inestimable natural gifts, wisdom, love, music, science, poetry, are all stamped down and left to boil with the dregs of an elementally corrupted nature. And thousands upon thousands of souls are destroyed by vice and misery and degradation, obliterated, wiped out, washed from the register of the living, dehumanized, end quote. He concludes that the condition of Harlem is a sign of divine judgment against the greed and prejudices of a wealthy and no less vicious white society. And this point is fair enough. But his grim depiction of Harlem leaves little room to appreciate the complex moral freedoms and strivings of the black people whom he paints with such a broad brush. Even as he laments their plight, he represents them as almost subhuman objects of fear and despair. 2 decades later, in the early 1960s, Merton more helpfully identifies fear as the very root of the problem. He says that white racists have, quote, a certain fear of the Negro, which he describes as, quote, a quasi-mystical obsession with a black demon waiting in the bushes to rape the virginal white daughters of the Old South, end quote. Such a sexualized Negrophobia is a false mysticism, according to Merton. It is a violent pseudo-spirituality. It is a demonic type of ecstasy governed by affective power rather than love or reason. And it is the greatest impediment to any meaningful practice of interracial brotherhood or solidarity. Merton suggests that true contemplation is its only real antidote, the sort of contemplation that would enable a white Christian to see black people not as objects of fear or even as persons to pity, but as their own brothers and sisters in Christ. But Merton goes a step further. He argues that to contemplate the true and living God, it is necessary to listen to Negro spirituals and freedom songs and to read black literature by the likes of James Baldwin and William Melvin Kelly. He says that these works, quote, tell us that it is the Negro who hears the true voice of God in history and interprets it rightly, end quote. Merton thinks that such an openness to the presence of God and the cultural artifacts of the black freedom struggle is a crucial step toward exorcising the demons from the hearts and structures of a white supremacist country. He is quite insistent on this point. He says, quote, the white man has lost his power to hear any voice other than his own inner demon who urges him to preserve the status quo at any price, however desperate, however iniquitous, and however cruel. The white man's readiness to destroy the world rather than change it is dictated by this inner demon, which he cannot recognize, but which the Negro clearly identifies, end quote. This inner demon is the source of that false mysticism that Merton is talking about. To be sure, Merton drew distinctions between different black sources. He did not think that the voice of God resonated equally or in quite the same way in all of them. He preferred the nonviolent Christian resistant movement of Martin Luther King Jr. to the overtly anti-Christian and sometimes anti-white rhetoric of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam. Nevertheless, Merton found much to value in Malcolm X's autobiography, and interpreted Malcolm's pilgrimage to Mecca as a turning point which opened him up to a more holistic sense of God's presence in the world. Although Merton worried that the black power leaders of the late 1960s might provoke forms of chaotic and counterproductive violence in the urban centers in the country, he viewed this as symptomatic of a more comprehensive problem of violence plaguing the country at large. He was mindful of the fact that the U.S. had never really come to terms with the violence in its history of slavery, and that the U.S. military was presently dropping bombs and killing civilians in Vietnam. He thought all of this was connected. he was less critical of black nationalist leaders than he was of white Christians who either resisted King's efforts or who naively viewed them as sufficient, as if everything had been taken care of by the 1964 Civil Rights Act, or as if there were no further need for black protest. Merton thought that the violence in urban slums and foreign rice fields started with white American Christians who had never dealt with the racial fears in their own hearts, who had never opened themselves up to the prospect of genuine brotherly love for black people or other subjugated peoples in various parts of the world, and who therefore remained captive to false and sinful versions of themselves. 50 years later, African Americans are still not approached with a passionate fraternal love that Merton argued they deserve. Black businesses and properties are consistently undervalued. Predominantly black schools are underfunded. The wealth gap between white and black Americans remains staggeringly high. While many black neighborhoods continue to be segregated and cut off from many benefits of infrastructure, such as highways and subways, there are also new problems of gentrification which make rents unaffordable and lead to displacements of families. Water sources in some black communities remain poisonous. Access to health care, including mental health care, is often unreliable, and its quality is often deficient, and black suicides of black youth are on the rise. Incarceration rates for nonviolent offenders are disproportionately high in black and brown communities. There are persistent problems of police brutality, including police shootings of unarmed black men, women, and children, and frequent miscarriages of criminal justice in the courts through racial bias. And xenophobic hate crimes and white supremacist terrorist organizations are on the rise. The current president has a well-documented history of white supremacist attitudes, remarks, and policies, but this has not deterred millions of Christians from voting for him. While inheriting the legacies of the civil rights and black power movements of the 1960s, new nonviolent activist movements such as Black Lives Matter have raised awareness and sought political and cultural reforms around a number of these issues. This new style of racial justice activism has tended to be neither Christian nor anti-Christian, neither religious nor secular. It occupies a liminal space of variously defined spiritual and material strivings, and it is arguably filling a moral vacuum left by religious institutions that have recently shown little, if any, leadership on matters of racial justice. If Merton were writing today, he would undoubtedly urge white Christians to discern the loving presence of God in such movements as Black Lives Matter. He would ask them to incorporate their grassroots struggles for black lives into their own intellectual, social, and historical fabric of their practice of contemplation. And he would insist that the very state of their souls, whether of grace or sin, truth or falsity, goodness or evil, depended on it. He would not condemn white Christians simply for being white, as if the external features of their bodies somehow sealed their fate. Rather, he would invite them to discover and grow into truer versions of themselves. He would ask them to let their hearts and minds be filled with a Christ-like love for all of God's precious children, so that they might recognize the presence of Christ in their black brothers and sisters, and even in themselves, and join together in struggle for a better world. According to Merton, even the most catastrophic and world-shattering forms of violence are rooted in the selfish fears, desires, and choices of particular egos, which are clinging tightly to themselves instead of opening themselves up to the immeasurable possibilities of divine love. Although he recognized that the racism of the U.S. was structural in nature, he also argued that it was a crisis for the soul of each person who had the opportunity and obligation to do something about it. Beyond the national problem of racism, which of course also has international dimensions, the type of violence that was most existentially troubling for Merton in his own lifetime was the threat of catastrophic nuclear war. This was an apocalyptic violence which could destroy every living creature on Earth. Its potential scope was truly global. And yet he thought its roots also lied in each one of us. It was our own inner violence which we might choose either to unleash or to overcome. Only love, he wrote, can exorcise the fear which is the root of all war. And he thought that this same love was the only real answer to the world-destroying power of the nuclear arms race. Today, I suspect he would say that this same love is once again our only hope against environmental catastrophe. The issue is not just warming temperatures, which might make summers more uncomfortable. The problems have to do with temperatures so hot, especially in equatorial regions, that human life becomes unlivable and impossible. Massive flooding of low-lying coastal cities throughout the world, the displacement of millions of people who will lose their homes and have nowhere to go, the increased severity of hurricanes, blizzards, wildfires, and droughts, which will mean greater loss of human life, destruction of habitats, and the threat of extinction for many animal and plant species, including some like bees who are crucial for our own survival, and dangerously increased levels of political and economic instability in all parts of the world. These impacts will be felt especially by poorer and more racially marginalized communities who already suffer from higher rates of pollution and water and food scarcity. Whether it is best to talk about these problems in apocalyptic terms, as if they mean the very end of the world, is a disputed question. The damage in this case does not happen in an instant like a nuclear blast. What we are witnessing is a gradual yet accelerating deterioration of life-sustaining relationships between human beings, animals, and their environment. Some forms of this damage, once they occur, are irreversible, and so there is a certain tragic finality to them. But the other point I want to make is that without the sort of ecological conversion recently proclaimed by Pope Francis, the world will continue on a path toward its own destruction. Our present course is not a good one to be on. The violence within us is severing our ties with the living things around us, and it is as if we are no longer concerned to find a harmonious way to exist within the beautiful world that God has made. I was pondering our ecological crisis while reading through Merton's collected poems, and I was struck by his love for the natural world around him. Contemplation was, for him, not merely a way to connect with other human beings as brothers and sisters in Christ, but also a way to experience intimate bonds with animals, plants, mountains, fields, rains, winds, and all kinds of natural phenomena. Let me read you just one such poem called In the Rain and the Sun. Watch out for this peeled door light. Here, without rain, without shame, my noonday dusk made spots upon the walk. Tall drops pelled the concrete with their jewelry, belonging to the old world's bones. Owning this view, in the air of a hermit's weather, I count the fragmentary rain in drops as blue as coal, until I plumb the shadows full of thunder. My prayers supervise the atmosphere till storms call all hounds home. Out of the towers of water, four or five mountains come walking to see the little monks' graves. Flying the neutral stones, I dwell between cedars and see the country sleeping in their beds. Lands of the watermen, where poplars bend, wild seas amuse the world with water. No end to all the surfs that charm our shores. fattening the sands with their old foam and their old roar. Thus, in the boom of waves' advantage, dogs and lions come to my lame home, won by the bells of my Cistercian jungle. O love the livid fringes in which their robes are drenched. Songs of the lions and whales, with my pen between my fingers, making the water world sing. Sweet Christ, discover diamonds and sapphires in my verse, while I burn the sap of my pine house for praise of the ocean sun. I have walked upon the whole day's surf, rinsing thy bays with hymns. My eyes have swept horizons clean of ships and rain. Upon lacquered swells my feet no longer run. Sliding all over the sea, I come to the hap of a slippery harbor. Dogs have gone back to their ghosts and the many lions home. But words fling wide the windows of their houses. Adam and Eve walk down my coast, praising the tears of the treasurer's son. I hang thy rubies on these autumn trees, on the bones of the home-going thunder. I do not know how exactly to parse every line of this beautiful poem, but its joyful attention to the beauty of creation is unmistakable. The poem is wet and spacious and alive. These are not the words of someone who would turn away in apathy as the world is gradually disfigured into an unlivable wasteland. This is a poem of one who, like St. Francis of Assisi, seeks to praise God with all of creation. In closing, let me pose a few questions for personal reflection. What fruit will your own practice of contemplation yield? What demands will it make of you in your life? How will it change your understanding of yourself? How will it shape the way you relate to others who are different from you, or whom you perhaps fear? How will it alter your relationships with the natural world that you witness every day? What moments of crisis or kairos do you have in your life right now? And how will you respond to them? I believe that these are the sorts of questions that Merton would want us to ask, trusting that if we are ready to listen, God will give us the answers. Thank you.